From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Iraq is now occupied by Western armies, led by the United States, and Palestine continues to be occupied. And every single day I get emails from the Israeli peace movement, Gush Shalom, and people working with them, and human rights monitors, of episodes which take place in some part of Palestine, people being shot, people being killed, children dying every single day. Children dying, in many cases, not shot in the arm or the leg by accident, but shot in the head. And the world stays silent and watches.
Today, Tariq Ali on Bush in Babylon. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A new survey of nearly 2,000 U.S. troops in Iraq found half of those polls described their unit's morale as low and said they did not plan to reenlist. The survey was conducted by the Pentagon-funded Stars and Stripes newspaper. 40% of the troops also said the war in Iraq was of little or no value. The paper reported some soldiers who'd complained about morale problems face disciplinary actions which can result in reprimand, extra duties, and forfeiture of pay. Soldiers interviewed by Stars and Stripes said the Pentagon is hand-picking what troops have a chance to meet with dignitaries when they travel to Iraq for tours and photo ops. The paper reported, quote, some troops even go so far as to say they've been ordered not to talk to VIPs because leaders are afraid of what they might say. In Gaza, Palestinian police have arrested three people, including members of the Popular Resistance Committee, for their role in Wednesday's bombing that killed three Americans. The Americans have been described as security guards who worked for the private military contractor DynCorp. DynCorp reportedly was hired to provide security for U.S. embassy officials in Tel Aviv. The bombing was the first to target Americans during the three-year intifada. In response, Washington sent FBI investigators to the area and called on all Americans to leave Gaza. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan today warned about the growing split between Islam and Western countries. In a statement before the Organization of the Islamic Conference, Annan said, quote, we must unite our efforts to address the extremism that is, alas, on the rise, not only in Islam, but among many faiths. In Saudi Arabia, more than 150 people have been arrested for protesting in the capital of Riyadh. The BBC reports police fired shots in the crowd of male and female demonstrators who were calling for political reform. The arrest came during the country's first ever human rights conference. Analysts say the protest shook the Saudi monarch, but publicly the government dismissed the demonstrators. The country's interior minister said, quote, what happened was just a limited gathering in the street. They're a small bunch. This won't happen again, he said. Saudi Arabia's leading religious authority condemned the protest, saying, quote, demonstrations are the behavior of non-Muslims. The U.S. House of Representatives has voted 398-4 to impose new sanctions against Syria. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay said, quote, Syria is a government at war with the values of the civilized world and a violent threat to free nations and free men everywhere. Backers of the sanctions have charged Syria as attempting to acquire nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. The Arab American Institute warned the sanctions will weaken moderate forces within Syria who are seeking political change. Meanwhile, tensions increased along the Syria-Iraq border. Agence France-Presse is reporting U.S. forces killed several men identified as foreign fighters along the border. New York Times reports several top officials at the Justice Department and FBI are privately criticizing Attorney General John Ashcroft's decision not to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate who within the Bush administration leaked the identity of a CIA operative. Ashcroft, a former Republican senator and governor of Missouri, has deep ties to some officials within the White House, including President Bush's senior advisor, Karl Rove, who is one of the people reporters have said talked to them about Joseph Wilson's wife. Time magazine recently reported Ashcroft paid Rove's former company nearly $750,000 between 1984 and 1994 for offering direct mail services to Ashcroft's campaigns in Missouri for governor and senator. He is also one of those, Karl Rove is, who lobbied President Bush to appoint John Ashcroft as attorney general. He was not Bush's first choice. An advisory group of the Food and Drug Administration voted yesterday to urge the government to overturn a decade-old ban on silicone breast implants, despite warnings from women who suffered serious health effects from the implants. In New York, at least 10 people are dead, 34 injured, when a ferry that connects Manhattan and Staten Island crashed into a terminal. Police said the operator of the ferry fled the scene and attempted suicide at his nearby home. The independent commission investigating the September 11th attacks yesterday threatened to subpoena records from the Federal Aviation Administration that might shed light on how the FAA responded after four airplanes were hijacked. The FAA has so far refused to hand over some of the requested documents. The commission also warned other agencies could face subpoenas if requested documents are not handed over. And a soon-to-be-published book entitled The Faith of George W. Bush reports that during his run for president, George W. Bush told a Texas preacher, quote, "I feel like God wants me to run for president. I can't explain it, but I sense my country is going to need me. I know it won't be easy on me or my family, but God wants me to do it." Celia Cruz here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Bolivia. Two miners were killed, scores more wounded yesterday as tank-backed troops and police opened fire on demonstrators converging on the country's capital of La Paz. A human rights group is saying 86 people have been killed in the 4 weeks of demonstrations against President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. This, according to the Agence France-Presse, President Sanchez de Lozada offered to call a referendum on a $5 billion natural gas U.S. export deal that triggered protests across the country. Opposition leaders Evo Morales and Felipe Quispe immediately rejected the offer, renewed their demand Sanchez de Lozada resign. In a televised address to the nation, the president also warned that if his proposal was not accepted and violence continued, quote, "it'll become evident that protesters are aiming to thwart constitutional order." He's rejected calls to stand down. The government, meanwhile, announced the discovery in Paracamaya, 62 miles from the capital, of a huge cache of munitions, dynamite, detonators, and boosters. And the BBC is reporting that an Indian leader is prepared to wage civil war to remove the president. Fraya Mansila Maiku said in a telephone statement, quote, "We're ready because we prefer to die than always to be suffering." Catherine Lederer is on the phone now, director of the Andean Information Network and consultant for the Washington Office on Latin America. She joins us from Cochabamba. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Catherine.
Thank you very much.
Can you describe what is happening there now?
Well, the situation continues to be very, very tense. Protests are spreading across many parts of the nation. Cochabamba is entirely shut down. La Paz has been shut down for several weeks. That means that there is no public transportation. All the stores are closed. The banks are closed. And there are constant protests in the streets. Protesters are met with tear gas, rubber pellets, and sometimes live ammunition. There has been a movement on the part of highly respected figures. Ana Maria Romero de Campero, the ex-human rights ombudsman person, has initiated a hunger strike along with members of the Catholic Church and the Human Rights Assembly, demanding that Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada step down. At the same time that Sanchez de Lozada made the offer for a referendum and a revision of the gas laws, police and military were carrying out illegal searches and beatings of protesters and families in El Alto. There was a dynamite attack on the transmission tower of a progressive radio station in Oruro. Copies of the progressive newspapers were confiscated. And so the feeling from a large bulk of the population is that a government that is making democratic offers while they continue to act democratically cannot be trusted.
Is the whole country in revolt?
Many, many sectors of the country are in revolt. There are still areas such as Santa Cruz that are the oil-producing area that has more limited protests. But most of the Andean part of the country is now engaged in blockades or some form of protest, and that seems to grow daily.
We're talking to Catherine Lederer, director of the Andean Information Network and a consultant for the Washington Office on Latin America. How does this compare to the protests of several years ago when troops opened fire, when people were protesting in Cochabamba against the Bechtel privatization of water?
Well, the water war in Cochabamba, the form of protest and government repression here in Cochabamba is very, very similar. But that was a protest that was isolated specifically to the Cochabamba region. Now we have the nationwide protest. We have a much higher death count. We're talking about over 70 people killed within a one-week period. And so the violence continues to escalate. This is also a national problem where many, many sectors are asking for Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada to resign. The U.S. government has come out very strongly in support of Sanchez de Lozada, stating that the American people and their government support the democratically elected president and that the United States will not tolerate any interruption of constitutional order and will not support any regime that results from undemocratic means. This has provoked a great deal of frustration here because the concern is that the United States will not permit Sanchez de Lozada to step down.
Catherine Lederer, I want to thank you for being with us from Cochabamba. Catherine is director of the Andean Information Network, and you are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now, a new report issued yesterday by the International Institute for Strategic Studies found the war in Iraq has helped al-Qaeda increase its size and galvanize the group's will. The report concluded in part, quote, "War in Iraq has probably inflamed radical passions among Muslims and thus increased al-Qaeda's recruiting power and morale, and at least marginally, its operating capability." The report by the International Institute for Strategic Studies is considered to be the annual Bible for defense analysts. Today we're going to hear a speech by Tariq Ali. He's author of Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq. His book combines Iraqi and Arab history and world politics. Without knowing the past, he says, it is impossible to understand what is happening today, and the history is presented as a warning to both occupier and resistor. We turn now to Tariq Ali, who began his speech by talking about there being two ways to deal with 911, he said in New York at the Riverside Church, one being political and one military.
The political method involved asking yourself the question, what it was that induced large numbers of young, middle-class professionals, people graduating from universities in the Arab world and outside, to join organizations like Al-Qaeda? Why were they doing it? And if you begin to ask that question, you are then compelled to look at the region and see what's going on. And at that moment, three things were going on. One, you had the occupation, the continuing occupation of Palestine, which was upsetting large numbers of people in that world. Secondly, you had the continuing sanctions against Iraq, which according to UNESCO and the United Nations has cost the lives of 500,000 children, wrecked the social infrastructure of Iraq, prevented the regime from implementing what it was doing before the war of giving people a decent health service, shelter, education. And thirdly, the support being given to the venal Arab regimes which were backing the West and had backed the West for the last 20 years. These were the three reasons. Now what happened? What happened? Did anyone discuss seriously what to do when attacks of terror take place like this? There were examples from the rest of the world. Long years ago, when the Irish Republican Army attempted to blow up the entire British cabinet and came close to doing it with Mrs. Thatcher as their central target, the British did have two options. They could have gone on a rampage in Northern Ireland. They could have destroyed the southern Armagh, where the headquarters and the strength of the IRA were. They could have bombed Dublin if they'd wanted to. They could have invaded. What did they do? After a pretty outrageous attack, which nearly took off the entire front bench of the Conservative leadership, they decided to negotiate. Secret negotiations were begun 3 months after that attack because they wanted to bring this to an end. And if the American administration had been serious about dealing with 9/11, they would have put first massive pressure on the regime in Israel to pull out of the occupied territories. To withdraw to the 67 frontiers, which is what the Israeli peace movement demands, which is what those brave Israeli reservists, several hundred of them, have said they refuse to serve in the occupied lands anymore. But they didn't do it. Instead, Ariel Sharon became a valued ally in the war against terror. He was given the green light to go and do whatever he wanted to do. And instead of ending the sanctions against Iraq, instead of ending the 12-year bombing campaign against Iraq, where bombs were dropped on that country every single week, so much so that American military spokesmen told the New York Times, "We've run out of targets to bomb. There's nothing left to bomb." This is the country, they said, posed a threat to the United States of America and its aircraft carrier in the near the North Sea called Britain. The aircraft carrier called Britain felt threatened. They said this aircraft carrier can be destroyed in 45 minutes by a hit from Saddam Hussein. Then it turned out that was a lie. Because just as the regime here has been lying, the regime in Britain has been lying to its people. So they did exactly the opposite. And what has happened as a result? This is what partially explains the massive turnout on February the 15th. Because millions of people marched, as you know. including in your country. Every single state capital had a big demonstration. 60,000 people marched in Minnesota in freezing temperatures. Unheard of. 1 million of you marched in New York. 800,000 marched in San Francisco. Large demo. Why? Why? Most of the people who came out and joined these marches, it was the first time they had ever done something like this. Because, unfortunately, the American left isn't that strong. These were ordinary people coming out because they were disturbed by what they saw as the irrational nature of this war that was being prepared. They understood it. Instinctively, they saw that. It's wrong. We are being fed lies. There is no rational reason for this war.
Tariq Ali, Bush in Babylon, the recolonization of Iraq. We'll be back with him in a minute. Milud, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with author, writer, journalist Tariq Ali, Bush in Babylon, the recolonization of Iraq.
Pentagon generals were leaking stuff to the newspapers here saying that they didn't know why this war was taking place. In Britain, you had an amazing development. Britain is a far more secretive country than the United States, where people tend to leak quite regularly. Which is a good thing, as Amy would agree. We need more people to leak. But Britain is a very secretive country, and there is a culture of secrecy there. So when you have, after the fall of Baghdad, you have a letter written to a daily newspaper in Britain, the Financial Times, signed by Sir Roderick Braithwaite, former head of the Joint Intelligence Committee, based in 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's official residence, a former National Security Advisor to Tony Blair at number 10 Downing Street. And what does this letter say? That the fall of Baghdad means nothing. He says the British people were skeptical about this war, and they were lied to. Housewives were told to stock up goods for 3 weeks in case of terrorist attacks. Tanks were sent to Heathrow Airport. By the way, even at the time the tanks were sent to Heathrow Airport, we knew it was fake because a number of policemen on the demonstration said, you don't have to believe that because when it was 5:30, the tanks clocked off and went back home, so it's not serious. And then they frightened people that within 45 minutes, Britain could be hit, dragooned the entire population, attempted to intimidate people, frighten them. And partially they succeeded, not completely. And the head of the Joint Intelligence Committee said, fishmongers sell fish, warmongers sell war. I think our prime minister oversold his wares. This is unheard of. That indicates that there was a very strong resistance to this war inside the establishment of that country. When Blair sent 1/3 of the British army to occupy bases in southern Iraq, which had been British bases in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and which had been removed at that time after a fierce resistance. So they went to war, the great leaders of the free world. And what happened? What did they imagine would happen? I'll tell you what they thought would happen. They thought they would be welcomed with sweets and flowers by the population of Iraq. And why did they think that? Because a handful of Iraqi quislings, collaborators on the payroll of the intelligence agencies here, or wanting to be on the payroll of the intelligence agencies, queuing up for largesse or university positions, went to the White House and told Bush this will be a war of liberation, just like Japan and Germany after the Second World War. And this administration believed them. The intelligence services in the United States didn't believe them. The CIA was nervous. The Defense Intelligence Agency was nervous. The generals in the Pentagon were nervous, but not the neocons, not the man in the White House, not his deputy dog. None of them were nervous. They wanted to go to war. And what had to happen, happened. We warned them in speeches, in writings, in essays, if you go to war against Iraq, remember one thing. This is not Pristina. This is not the Balkans. This is not even Afghanistan. This is a sovereign, independent Arab state who you are attacking for no rhyme or reason. And even though the population doesn't like Saddam Hussein, they will hate you even more and they will resist you. And that's exactly what happened. And that's exactly what happened. The resistance first started in the south. Strongholds of anti-Saddam's resistance in the old days. That's where the resistance first started. Then it spread. The mistake I made, and I admit it, I thought it would take about 6 months for the resistance to commence in Iraq. I was wrong, happily. It started very quickly. And you know what never fails to surprise me? Is how many people in the United States and even in Britain are surprised that people don't like being occupied. It's a big mystery to lots of people here that the Iraqis, in their majority, do not like being occupied. Well, it's no mystery in that world. And the reason it isn't a mystery in that world is that Iraq is a country with a history of resistance. This is what I try and explain in my new book, Bush in Babylon. The title I chose deliberately because I thought it was the only title the great thinker president would understand. Babylon being an Old Testament city. But what I try to show is that a country with such a strong tradition of resistance against one empire and a young country formed only in the early 20s, with that strong tradition, there are large numbers of people still alive who remember that resistance and have created a consciousness in Iraq, regardless of Saddam Hussein or anyone else, have created a consciousness in Iraq which is a consciousness of a people with a historical memory. Their memory has not been wiped out. And that's why they don't take kindly to being occupied by foreign powers. And that's why the resistance in Iraq will grow. At the moment, it's at the first stage, classical first stage of resistance to a foreign occupation. Low-intensity guerrilla warfare, targeting of certain buildings, certain people, to try and make the country ungovernable. And they've done it. And the only social layer in Iraq, which might have supported the intervention and occupation, the layer of merchants who the British used as a prop when they were ruling the country for 25 years, are completely hostile to what's going on because the aim of this particular occupation is obvious. This is not an occupation which takes place in the pattern of traditional colonial occupations. This is an occupation in an epoch of neoliberal capitalism. So you cannot have what the old states used to do, provide some semblance of normality to countries they occupied. This empire imposes on Iraq not just its military, but as Amy pointed out very eloquently, also imposes on this country its companies, its businessmen, its privatized mercenaries, its operators on every level. And deep down it understands that the occupation is unpopular because it will not even hire local people to do the cleaning up jobs in the American barracks. South Asian workers, Filipino workers are brought in to do that work. And if you are in an occupation where you can't trust any section of the country, then in reality you recognize that this occupation is doomed. And so the talk which we hear, the bravado, that is reminiscent. There are not many analogies with Vietnam. But one of the analogies which does apply is the lies you are fed by the politicians and generals there who have to tell lies to justify the occupation. Yes, there are a few problems, but send us a few more troops and it will get better. The white-haired among you will recall the grave-visaged General Westmoreland standing in Saigon year after year and saying the war will be over this Christmas. Now, no one in Iraq wants this occupation. No one wants innocent American soldiers to die. They are perfectly aware of this. They know that the bulk of the army is an army of the poor. That's what it is. It's an army of some of the poorest people in this country who join in order to get a job, in order to get an education in many cases, as you know full well. Many join because they feel this is the way they will get to college, they will get an education after they've served their term there. They didn't know they were going to be sent to occupy militarily. If this government believes it has the support of the American people, then let's make it a democratic war. Let's have a draft so that every single person has to face exactly the same threat. I know it's not popular, but why? If you're fighting for enduring freedom, if this is the great cause of democracy, then go and fight for it. Don't send the poorest people in your country to fight for it. Why should they suffer? But they won't do that. They won't do that because it'll be completely unpopular. And they will begin to boost the size of the anti-war movement in this country so that it'll become irresistible. Now, people say, how do we resist the American Empire? Those who are directly occupied will resist it as they do. What other means is left open to them? People say, what if there's an election in Iraq? The British organized an election when they occupied Iraq, where 2/3 of the seats were not contested. You can have elections like that. But if you have a proper election in Iraq to elect a constituent assembly, I'm prepared to bet anything that amongst the first two demands of this elected constituent assembly, one, all foreign troops, all occupying troops out of Iraq, and second, Iraqi control of Iraqi oil. And countries which have oil, that's not the reason for this war, the exclusive or even the major reason for this war. But countries which have oil, just look at their history. The West prefers these countries to be ruled by dictatorships or oligarchies who can safeguard the oil. That's why they toppled the democratic regime in Iran in 1953 and brought the Shah back because they wanted someone they could rely on. And they wiped out all secular alternatives. They tortured them. They drove them out of the country. So the only doors that were left open were the doors of the mosque, and then they have the nerve to attack the Iranians to make a clerical revolution. What other hope did you leave there? when you put the Shah back on the throne. And that's what they did in most of the Middle East during the Cold War. In order to wipe out secular nationalists, inflict defeats on them, they used Israel as the battering ram, and the clericals in Saudi Arabia as the ideological weapon to defeat the enemy within, destroy them. They did it in Indonesia. 1.5 million people were killed in Indonesia. And many of the vigilantes who participated in the killings are now people leading the Islamist organizations. Every single case. Osama bin Laden, you know full well. And it's not going to work like that for either side. You have to have movements in that region which have a social vision. And in Iraq, you will have such movements. So people know instinctively in the State Department that any talk of immediately privatizing the Iraqi oil will offend every section of Iraqi society. So if you look at their websites, they're saying, go easy on it. Don't raise the question of oil just yet. I'll give you another example. If you really need to be convinced that this is about democracy, look at the other oil-producing country in the South American continent, Venezuela. They tried to topple Hugo Chavez, who has been elected in different capacities 6 different times by the people of Venezuela. They tried to organize a coup. They organized a coup to defeat him. The coup succeeded for 48 hours. And the fraudster and corrupt businessman they were swearing in as president of Venezuela was going to be introduced as the new freedom fighter, the guy who was going to fight for freedom and who had defeated the forces of evil. That's what the New York Times said. After Chavez was removed, a coup had taken place, the New York Times said, democracy in Venezuela has been enhanced. Well, yes, in a way it had. The sort of democracy they believe in, a democracy which only protects the interests of capital. That's what they believe in. But Chavez came back because 500,000 of the poor in Caracas marched outside the Miraflores Palace. And the soldiers told their officers, we will not support the coup. There were threats of mutiny inside the army. And I want to give you an example of this. Outside the palace, Miraflores Palace, there is a band which plays the national anthem. There is a 17-year-old soldier, boy soldier, whose only job is to play the bugle. He's the bugler. Every time the president comes out, he plays the bugle. The general who made the coup came and told the band, the new president is coming out, you get ready to play the national anthem, and he told the bugler, you play the bugle. And these rank-and-file soldiers said, why? Why do we have a new president? We've got an elected one, Hugo Chavez. What's happened to him? And the general said, it's not your business to ask me that question. So he told the bugler, the minute I bring the new president out, you will play the bugle. And the bugler said, but my president is Hugo Chavez. And the general said, you will obey orders. And this 17-year-old kid said to the general, you seem to be really keen on playing the bugle. Here, play it yourself. Now, that's a spirit which can exist in different parts of the world. And that's a spirit now which is coming up in Iraq. There are 44 different resistance organizations, small, big, composing every political current. The next stage for this resistance will be to try and create a nationwide organization, a national organization to resist the occupation. And I'll tell you something else. Just think and ask yourselves, what would have happened in the world and the political situation in this country if there had been no resistance at all? It's the resistance in Iraq, whether they admit it or not, which gave some democratic politicians the courage to find their tongues again and to say perhaps there was something wrong in the war. They wouldn't have done it if nothing had happened in Iraq. They wouldn't have done it without that. So we have a situation in the Middle East today which is a mess, a complete mess. We have a dual occupation of that region. Iraq is now occupied by Western armies, led by the United States, and Palestine continues to be occupied. And every single day I get emails from the Israeli peace movement, Gush Shalom, and people working with them, and human rights monitors, of episodes which take place in some part of Palestine, people being shot, people being killed, children dying every single day. Children dying in many cases, not shot in the arm or the leg by accident, but shot in the head. And the world stays silent and watches. In Europe, at least, there's some reporting of this. But the media, the official media in this country, not Democracy Now, the official media in this country is totally blind to the suffering of the Palestinian people. Why? I advise them sometimes when I debate them. Why don't you just publish in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times just a few articles which are already being published in the Israeli press and which show exactly what's going on? Then no one will accuse you. Just reprint these articles from the Israeli press. But they don't do it. They don't do it. Because the interests of the American empire have got very badly entangled with the operation of Zionism in Israel. That's what's happened. But I'll tell you something. Even decent, honest Zionists are now upset. Recently, I don't know whether this article was published in the United States, probably not. It was published in European newspapers, an article by Abraham Burg, a former chairman of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, saying, I am ashamed to be a Zionist because of what is being done in our name to the Palestinians. And this man asks, if you make the Palestinians totally despair, if you crush all their national aspirations, if you go and shoot and kill them every day, how else do you expect them to behave? Basically, what he's saying, that when the daily life of a people becomes so awful that they sometimes feel it might be easier to die than to live, then they are prepared to risk their lives and take others with them. That's the reality of what is going on in Palestine.
You're listening to Tariq Ali. He is author of Bush and Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq. We'll be back with him in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we return to Tariq Ali, Middle East expert, author, journalist. His latest book is Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq, speaking in New York two nights ago.
We march, we demonstrate, we protest. I think we have to think a bit beyond that. There are examples from your own country. I know there are some people, very fashionable in the media as pundits, who imagined that somehow the American empire only came into existence to fight communism. Not true. It came into existence to first control this country and then expand into Latin America. And this it did for most of the 19th century in one way or the other. It became a player on the global stage after the First World War. when it felt it had to go in because a revolution had already happened in February 1917 in Russia, crowned heads were threatened in Austria and Germany, and they felt there would be chaos unless they went in. But they were a big imperial power in this region for many years before that. That's what the Monroe Doctrine was about. Then they went for a few adventures in the Pacific. The Philippines, which they occupied at the end of the 19th century. And that occupation of the Philippines moved American liberals and American intellectuals and American writers and American artists like nothing else had done before. And Mark Twain and Henry James, William James, and numerous others signed a public appeal calling for the formation, this is in 1898, calling for the formation of an anti-imperialist league to curb the imperial adventures of the United States of America. And within a year, it had a quarter of a million paid-up members in 30 different cities of the United States. Now, we need to think like that, because this is not a problem which will go away. As the students who spoke here pointed out, we have to build for the future. They are planning. The Israelis were given the go-ahead to bomb Syria. They are threatening Iran because it has a nuclear reactor. It will end badly for them, but it will go on for a while. So I think we have to think in the long term. And the young people, especially, who came out onto the streets on February the 15th, especially from the schools, but the colleges as well, of this country, represent the hope and the future of this country. That's what was so remarkable, not just here, but also in Europe, that suddenly it became cool to be politically engaged again. It hadn't been cool for the last 20 years. The Reagan-Thatcher generations had not been interested in that. The MTV ideology, don't worry, be happy, had gone quite deep. And so when this generation came out and marched on the streets, it was a sign of hope for everyone. And it shocked the establishments all over the world. They had not expected this to happen because they thought we were now living in a post-political age. We were living in an age where there were no conflicts, as they constantly pretended. No conflicts at home, no conflicts at abroad. All we are doing is humanitarian interventions. That's why we go in. Don't worry about it. Don't think about it. And if we go into Afghanistan, you'll get worried for a few weeks, then it'll go off the networks, then you'll forget it exists, but it exists. The war in Afghanistan, which they waged after 9/11. We told them it won't work. The aim was to crush Al-Qaeda. But Al-Qaeda was not an organization which belonged to any state. It ran away naturally. It went and hid. When your great leader announced that one of the central demands of the Afghan war was the head of Osama bin Laden dead or alive, how did he expect to find him when he arrived 3 months later at the Tora Bora Caves? Did he really think Osama would be sitting there, sipping tea, waiting? Why should he? He's not, you know, crazy in that sense. They left. They went away. They couldn't even capture poor old Mullah Omar, the one-eyed leader of a faction of the Taliban, wounded in one leg, suffering, limping everywhere, but no surveillance machine could find him. And finally they said he disappeared. And we said, where did he disappear? They said he was last seen, he was going on a motorbike in the direction of the desert. Like Steve McQueen. So these two guys they wanted to find, they couldn't find them. And last week, the poor guy they put into power in Kabul opened negotiations with the Taliban to try and bring them into the government. But stop. You say, excuse us. We thought the whole point of the war, when they couldn't destroy Al-Qaeda, was to destroy this wicked, vicious, evil regime, the worst regime the world has ever seen. But today we are talking to them again. They had told us, Mrs. Bush and Mrs. Blair, in their nice tete-a-tete on American television, that this was a war to liberate women. It's the first time in the history of the world that a state goes to war to fight for women's liberation. That's never happened before. And when they first took Kabul, which wasn't resisted, they actually found an Afghan woman and made her read the news, and this was flashed around on all the world's networks to show that women have been liberated. You talk to the women's organizations in Afghanistan today, and they'll tell you to what extent they've been liberated. All that's been liberated is the fact that the heroin trade, which was controlled by two different factions, one which used Pakistan as an outlet, which was close to the Taliban, and the other close to the Northern Alliance, which used the Russian mafia as their main conduit and used Kosovo as the main base of the heroin trade, they were fighting each other. But with the defeat of the Taliban, the Northern Alliance mafia became very dominant, and now they exercise a monopoly. That's been the concrete result of the war. Nothing else. That you've given the heroin monopoly to a bunch of gangsters running large parts of the country. What else has happened? Democracy? When Hamid Karzai, the guy you've put into power in Kabul, doesn't trust a single Afghan to be his bodyguard. Doesn't show a great deal of confidence in your own people. His brother's much better. He runs a restaurant in Baltimore, where he's invited me to go and have dinner after I speak at Johns Hopkins, and I will, to discuss the situation in Afghanistan. He's probably more intelligent and knows what's going on. And then they put this crook, Ahmed Chalabi, in power in Iraq, thinking he's going to change the world. Look, it isn't going to work. And when people ask, and they often ask me, how then do we remove unpopular regimes? I say to them, it's not up to you. It's up to the people of that country. All through the years of Cold War, when the United States put Pinochet in power in Chile and corpses were seen in the streets of that country, did anyone on the left or the liberal left or the solidarity movement with Chile demand an immediate Cuban intervention? When Indonesia saw 1.5 million corpses, did anyone demand an intervention from Beijing, even as a moral propagandistic demand? No. Because you know that they are defeats, and these defeats have to be overcome by the people themselves. And if they go into Iran, it will be a total disaster. I'll tell you why. Because the Iranian people today offer hope for the future in the world of Islam. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because 60% of the population of Iran is under 25 years of age, and 70% is under 35 years of age. All they have known is the rule of the clerics. For them, stories of the Shah and torture, etc., not exactly fairy tales, but something remote. They want to remove this regime. And the laws of biology are on their side. They will remove it. They will remove it in their own time. They will remove it in their own way, and they will bring a new regime which might even begin to reform this particular religion which has ruled them and oppressed them in that country. That's how you remove regimes. If the United States were to go in, it would strengthen the most backward elements in that regime. Look what's happening in Iran. Look at the Iranian movies that are coming out. Look at the poems that are being written. The novels that are being written clandestinely, being published in secret. It's a really vibrant Iranian intelligentsia, vibrant, wanting to get rid of all this. And they will. They will, unless the great empire goes and makes a mess as usual, as it's done in Afghanistan and as it's done in Iraq today. So that's the way we have to argue against those who say, but this regime is awful. Leaving aside all the other arguments, of course there are exceptions. Always in history there are exceptions. But the worst exception of the 90s was Rwanda, where there was a genuine mass genocide taking place where they couldn't do anything. Because Madame Albright had decided that an American presence in the Balkans was more important than what was happening in Rwanda and fired the UN Secretary General, who showed some independence and said this is a much worse crisis for the world than the Balkans. So obviously there are exceptions. But outside that, you have to leave it to the people. They will create their own institutions. That's the only way in which change can be organic. Interventions by imperial powers with whatever pretext they use never work. And in this struggle, which we will see, I think, continuing for 20 to 30 years in different ways, what happens in this country is vital. Without a strong American opposition, we are doomed. We need you. And everywhere I go and speak in different parts of the world where people don't know what goes on in the United States because the media only reports the official American media, I always say it's not a majority, but there is a strong opposition in the United States to what is going on. Never underestimate that. And this opposition has to be built, it has to be developed, it has to be organized, it has to be allowed to grow organically, build into a movement which finally challenges the corrupt and venal politicians who rule. There was a great, great historian of Iraq and Syria, Hanna Batatu, a Palestinian at the University of Georgetown. And in his last book on Syria, he wrote, there is a great deal of similarity between Ba'athist politicians and U.S. politicians. They are both equally remote from the people. Think about it. Think about it. So I would urge you, especially those of you who are coming into politics for the first time, don't give up if you don't succeed the first time. Don't get demoralized. We have lived through a period where there have been victories and defeats, and the one thing you've got to do is to be steadfast and carry on.
And that is Tariq Ali. He is author of Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq, speaking in New York this week, having just come over from London and now traveling across the country. The event sponsored by the Columbia University Anti-War Coalition. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to go to our website, you can go to www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. To get a copy of today's program, you can go to our website and get more information. And you can call 1-800-881-2359. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org. And if you'd like to sign up for our daily digest that lets you know the news that is coming and the news of the day, go to the website, democracynow.org. And that does it for today's program, Democracy Now!, produced by Jeremy Scahill, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Lenina Nadal, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Purvey Sharma, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim are our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.